Oh, thank you for coming back on another Friday. Welcome to the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Good to have you along with Joni Balter from Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel. Hi, Joni.
Hi.
Erica C. Barnett. Good afternoon to you. Covering the city at thecisforcrank.com. Hi, Erica.
Hi, Bill.
Chris Vance, former legislator, council member, Republican Party chair, former Republican. Welcome back.
Good to be here again.
You just told me a moment ago you've never seen anything like this in Olympia, and you've seen a lot.
No, I went to work in Olympia as a young staff person in 1985. I was a member for three legislative sessions. I've been down there every year in some capacity or another. I've seen a lot of crazy things.
Uh-huh.
I've seen bills pulled off the floor. I've seen deals made at the last minute.
Uh-huh.
But I've never seen
vases of flowers.
The thing that I'm about
floor.
To tell listeners about.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I've never seen anything like this.
Okay. And here's this. So the clock was ticking last night. Governor Inslee had until 11:59 to act on this controversial bill, a bill that would exempt state legislators from parts of the State Public Records Act. So this is about disclosure, transparency, editorial pages across our state. Blared, Governor, bring the legislature into the sunlight of disclosure. Veto this bill. It was national news. Governor Inslee was asked about it on MSNBC this week.
Reporters, newspapers, a lot of sunlight groups think it's a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know what your position is on that bill. Are you going to veto it?
I think it's a bad idea. I don't think it's necessary. Governors, I've been a legislator and an executive, and I know that you can have full disclosure and transparency.
So you're going to veto it?
And, well, I can't, unfortunately, because they have a veto-proof majority, unfortunately. So I don't have control at this moment.
But wait a minute. That's not how it works. He could veto it. And last night, before the clock chimed 12-fold, he did veto it. There was some suspense. Chris, the suspicion is that legislators didn't want us reading emails between them and lobbyists who want stuff. What do you think is the truth?
I think that there's two things going on here. And I could be wrong, because one thing I do know about the legislature, if you're not there every day behind closed doors, you really don't know. But what I'm guessing is two things. First of all, for many years, the legislature has believed they were not subject to this law. So they weren't careful with what they put in their emails and their public records, because
that doesn't sound prudent.
And all of a sudden they lose a lawsuit and the rules change and people say, hey, that's not fair. You know, I mean, so that's one thing. What they wanted to do was say that their records would be public after July 1st of this year, but not anything before. The second thing is, I think they have some concerns that now asking for public records is going to become part of the legislative strategy, where if you and I are legislators and we're emailing back and forth about our strategy to pass a bill and overcome the opposition of some interest group, that group's lobbyist does a public records request and finds out our strategy.
Oh, okay.
And so I think that's the other concern I think legislators have.
This was easily one of the five dumbest things the legislature has ever done. And please don't ask me for the other four.
Okay.
But the gist of it is, by doing this, by voting the way they did a week ago, what they were doing was setting up a situation by which every other piece of legislation that came up would be compared to the urgency level applied to this.
Yeah,
in other words,
almost no public hearing, very rush.
Right.
That's emergency feel to it.
Emergency in quotes, urgency in quotes, because everything would be compared to it. You mean you don't have a carbon tax? You mean you haven't taken care of gun legislation? You seem to, when you have a fire burning, able to do whatever it is you want, lickety-split, 48 hours. And so every bill, for as long as we could remember, this would go forward a couple years, would be compared to, oh, you're going to delay it till next year?
Mm.
Because we all saw, when you want to get something done that protects you, off you go.
Good point.
You know, I cover the city, the county, Sound Transit, and a lot of other agencies. I don't cover the legislature that much, but over the years, I've been kind of periodically astonished when I've been reminded that they think that the public disclosure law doesn't apply to them. And, you know, public disclosure is important, not just so you can find out what legislators are saying to lobbyists or catch them in embarrassing gaffes or whatever. It's important so we can know that the people that we elect are doing work that we consider important, prioritizing the right things. And if you think about, the legislature is really micropolitics in a way. The constituency of a single state house member is smaller than the constituency of a city mayor who is subject to public disclosure law. And I think people constituents should be very angry and be looking at the list of people who voted in the legislature for this bill to keep these public documents private. Because I'm not an attorney, but I don't believe that the legislature should be uniquely exempt among all public agencies to this law that applies to everybody else.
So Chris, these lawmakers may have argued that they shouldn't be subject to this law, but to Erica's point, do you have sympathy toward that? I mean, shouldn't their default be, well, we should be transparent to the public. So they say it's unfair. So what?
I have sympathy to the rank and file legislator who was told by their leadership and their lawyers, you're not going to be covered. You're okay. And then all of a sudden, so they operate under those rules, and then they're told that's not the case. For the institution as a whole, they should have done a long time ago what apparently they're going to do now, and that is sit down together with the media and negotiate a settlement to this lawsuit and come up with a system that is workable for both sides.
This is a lawsuit, the media claiming that they have access to these documents, emails, texts, calendar notes, and they had said no, and a Superior Court judge had ruled in favor of the media on this, but it hasn't gone through all the appeals.
And instead of negotiating, which is what you do to settle any lawsuit, the legislature said, no, we're going to ram a bill through as fast as we can, and if you don't like it, too damn bad. And they lost. But so now they're going to sit down and negotiate and hopefully come up with something that works. I'll only say one more thing. The legislature is different than every other government in this state, and here's why. I served on the county council. We met year-round. We could take our time. Things moved slowly. In Olympia, the entire culture is built around speed. They have to adjourn at a certain time.
They never adjourn at a certain time.
I was just going to say, Chris, that happens maybe in a short session,
no,
but in a long session, they just go.
It doesn't matter.
That doesn't excuse what they're doing.
Actually served there, I'm telling you, there are cutoffs and bills. Like tonight, every bill must be out of the House or Senate by 5 o'clock tonight. That means they have to move very quickly, and that's why their culture is more geared towards speed and less toward openness.
I don't think that excuses any of it. I'd like to talk a little bit about Washington culture, mm-hmm. which is public disclosure. It mm-hmm. couldn't be clearer that this is one of our values here. Mm-hmm. And I'll point to the creation of the Public Disclosure Commission in 1972. You know what the vote in favor of that was? 72%. We don't agree on anything but at that number. That is part of our culture, transparency. And one of the great ironies here is that once this whole thing that happened in Olympia was exposed, in other words, sunshine, that's when things started to change.
Let me give you the notion that
the legislature is a part-time body that doesn't meet all the time and they're citizen volunteers flies in the face of the fact that cities are often run by volunteers. Small cities are run by part-time mayors and they're subject to the law. I mean, I think a good example of the public disclosure law working, at least in part, is this week with Sound Transit, which I think we're going to get to a little later. Mm-hmm. A bunch of documents were released in response to a public disclosure request, I believe by Crosscut, that showed that quite clearly that the description of Sound Transit CEO Peter Rogoff's behavior in the public was different than what was being discussed behind the scenes. So I think that, you know, the notion that, well, they have to rush. Well, no. I mean, you see legislation. I mean, and you've been a legislator. You see that legislation takes years to pass. I mean, I've seen legislation work its way through just now this session, the Reproductive Parity Act, something mm-hmm. I worked on when I was at NARAL Pro-Choice Washington, took 6 years to pass. And we knew that. We knew it was going to take time. So I don't buy that the culture requires rushing.
Well, I'm sorry you don't buy it, but the whole culture in Olympia is about speed and moving very quickly. Because, give you two perfect examples. Last night, because of this whole brouhaha, the Senate adjourned early. And now there are dozens of bills, some of which I'm following for clients, which are on the Senate floor calendar, which are going to die today just because they're going to run out of time. The other thing is, like when I was in the county council, and every other government has to comply with the Open Public Meetings Act, which means you have to have a formal public hearing before you change the law, which means you have to sit and listen to every citizen who shows up to testify, no matter how long that takes. And that was fine. When I was in the county council, we literally had public hearings that lasted for 6-7 hours. If you did that with every bill in Olympia, you better be ready for a full-time, year-round professional legislature because you'd never be able to adjourn on time.
Well, I have time for one more.
Very, very quickly. I covered the city council and they cut off public comment, so I know it's possible.
No, they can't. They can limit the amount of time, but if they go too far, they're going to get smacked by a judge.
We didn't even say what this means about Jay Inslee, and so I just want to add there that it's not like, you know, he acted like in that clip that you played that he couldn't veto this. Of course, that's exactly what governors do. And he was looking at a choice between politicians and the public, which let him know in no uncertain terms that they wanted him to veto this. So, of course, he did that. And any other choice would have been political suicide. Jay Inslee's mentioned for president or vice president, or more likely under a Democratic president, something like climate czar.
Okay.
If he didn't do this, no go.
I'm out of time for the last thing I wanted to ask, so I can't ask it. But Inslee brings us to another important story of the week. I just want to say, I mentioned at the top, this bill would exempt state legislators from parts of the State Public Records Act. Lawmakers argue that the bill added significant transparency and would have made stuff public that currently isn't. And that's a big discussion. But let's pause there, because something's going to happen with the legislature and the governor. They're going to come back together and try to figure out this whole public disclosure thing. You mentioned Governor Inslee, because Washington would have been the first state in America to have a carbon tax if that had passed this week. It looked possible. Democrats have majorities now in the House and Senate, plus the governor. And it didn't happen again. Carbon tax failed this week. So I'll start again with the former legislator. Chris, is this like gun regulations? The public likes a carbon tax, but it never happens? Or is it what's the deal?
I think what happened here is the latest quarterly revenue forecast was so much higher than anyone had expected. The state now has more money than they thought they had. And so instead of raising any other tax, what the Democrats are doing now is working on a bill to actually lower the property tax that they passed last year. And so it made it intellectually impossible to say we need the money. I would guess.
Well, what about carbon dioxide pollution?
I would actually say that if the revenue forecast had not been so good, I think they would have had a chance to pass a carbon tax.
Interesting.
Well, I think that's an interesting point about revenue forecasts. We, in every level of government, tend to think very short term and get all excited when revenue forecasts are good, and then we have to cut when revenue forecasts are bad. When revenue forecasts are good, we forget that there's that future date on which we're going to have to cut. So this bill would not have been revenue neutral. It would have brought in revenues, unlike the initiative last year. And maybe, you know, as I think Inslee said, maybe in the future people will be more in the legislature will be more inclined to pass something that actually raises revenues when revenues aren't coming in quite so high.
So, Joni, my question for you is, I keep hearing that Inslee might run for president. How does pushing a carbon tax fit with that?
Well, that's part of his identity. He's trying to be the climate governor, and sounds like maybe the climate czar in another administration. And, you know, we all used to laugh at this idea, Jay Inslee running for president, ha, 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 you know. But I interviewed him and Oregon Governor Kate Brown early in February at Seattle University. And I was struck. I noticed he has ramped up his game. He is sharper on his feet. He's quicker on his feet. Climate could be his calling card for something after governor, and we used to laugh at that.
But is that a presidential winner? Like, how many states would copy Washington if we did this?
In 2020, the whole ball game is who's going to get the Democratic nomination, and the way to do that is to be liberal on something, and if not everything, and this is his this is his calling card. And I always wonder why people laugh about Jay running for president. Why not? He is been a successful two-term governor from a very interesting state. There's a lot of money in Washington State to start a campaign. I think Inslee's a very credible candidate for governor for the Democrats. People like to, because we know him, and I think too many of us still think of Washington as this small backwater. We're not.
Does it matter how, well, you mean because we have these Amazon and Microsoft Starbucks and Boeing?
We're the biggest state in the West other than California.
Okay.
First of all, there's a lot of people here and a lot of electoral votes, and there's a whole lot of money in Washington State.
Does anyone think a carbon tax becomes, sometimes things seem, they're not popular, they seem like a left-wing idea, but then other states follow, and then, oh yeah, carbon tax, that's one of the taxes we do. And we get closer, we get more and more, the climate changes more and more, the ice melts more and more. And
the problem with climate change is it's just an issue you can't see. And it's always going to have that problem, I think, until Florida is gone or, you know, something actually.
That will change the electoral map as well.
No kidding. But until something tangible affects actual people in a way that, you know, you can easily, that the media can easily report on. But you do see sea changes happen very quickly. I mean, look at.
You mean changes in the sea?
Good point. No pun intended, but yeah.
Okay. So tangible change in the way media can report, that will bring us to the gun, the week in guns in just a moment. Did I let you finish enough? Okay.
Good for me.
Okay, more of the Week in Review coming up, so please stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review this week is Erica C. Barnett, Chris Vance, Joni Balter, and I'm Bill Radke. Maybe those Florida students who were shot dead in their high school classrooms, maybe something is coming from that. This week, Washington State banned the bump stock trigger device that I'd never heard of before very recently, but that's happened in Washington. President Trump briefly supported regulations that the NRA hates. Major corporations have jumped into this, RAI, Fred Meyer, Walmart, Delta Airlines. What's important about what happened this week on the gun front, Erica?
Well, I think that, you know, as we were just discussing, things changing very quickly, I think that the NRA, you know, has been incredibly powerful for a really long time. It still is incredibly powerful. But I think there may be, this may be one of those social movements where, like Me Too, like same-sex marriage, where all of a sudden something that was considered off-limits, like banning certain types of guns. I don't think bump stocks is, I think that's a distraction issue, and I don't think it's particularly relevant to anything, but it could be a sign.
Not if you're an NRA slippery slope arguer.
Well, and, you know, and I, what I'm actually going to argue is I hope it's a slippery slope toward doing some reasonable gun regulations, and I think it might be because there seems to be such a you know, emotional response, particularly to these kids that are speaking out in Parkland. But I you know, I don't know what exactly to attribute that to, because Sandy Hook was equally horrifying, if not more so. You're talking about little kids who can't speak up for themselves, but it does feel like something might be changing.
Perhaps it's cumulative. That might be the thing, because I thought one of the most fascinating parts of this week was all these corporations saying that, ooh, NRA is icky all of a sudden. And even if, you know, there's retribution, as in Georgia, for, you know, the NRA there, the Delta Airlines situation.
But just for listeners who don't know, Delta Airlines said they wouldn't give an NRA
like a
discount?
Price break of some sort or, yeah. And so then the Georgia legislature just whacked their tax break that was on the docks right there. They just said, we don't care. We're doing this. But I'm talking more about the Dick's Sporting Goods. I'm talking about Fred Meyer. I'm talking about
Walmart.
All these folks are saying
L.L. Bean.
And if the owners of these companies are going to say, you know what, we don't want any part of this national awful story. We want to be separate. We don't want to be responsible for it. We're going to raise the age to 21, or we're not going to sell AR-15s. This is poignant, and it does, you know, business does change the game when the politicians are all going in a circle like Trump. You know, he had one line Wednesday. He was sort of like we used to joke about a city council member around here, the last one in the door before the vote would sway the politician. And
used to. So,
and well, okay, but yeah, so Trump had dinner or meetings or something with the NRA, and poof, his position had changed. So that's too hard to follow.
That's worth pausing and just playing a remarkable bit of audio of President Trump talking to his Vice President Mike Pence in this bipartisan meeting. So Vice President Pence is saying, well, Mr. President, maybe under some circumstances, the government could carefully, with due process, maybe take away some guns.
Yes, go ahead, Mike.
Well, in the category, you've spoken about it, Mr. President, gun violence restraining orders to literally give families and give local law enforcement additional tools if an individual is reported to be a potential danger to themselves or others. Allow due process so that no one's rights are trampled. But the ability to go to court, obtain an order, and then collect not only the firearms, but any weapons in the possession
or
of that
might
individual.
Or take the firearms first and then go to court, because that's another system. Because a lot of times, by the time you go to court, it takes so long to go to court to get the due process procedures. I like taking the guns early, like in this crazy man's case that just took place in Florida. He had a lot of firearms. They saw everything. to go to court would have taken a long time. So you could do exactly what you're saying, but take the guns first, go through due process second.
Quote, take the guns first, go through due process second. I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
It's horrifying. Even if you hate guns, every American should just be... The man's entire instincts are to be authoritarian and autocratic, and the hell with the Constitution, and the hell with due process. We're just going to do it. You know, that's just, and that's he wishes he could be a dictator. He's just not smart enough and competent enough to get there.
Well, it reminds me of his comments on killing all the drug dealers.
Or don't be gentle when you put them in the back of the police car. Slam their heads into the roofs. I mean, things like that. But I agree with the earlier discussion. Earthquakes happen when tectonic plates that have been static for a long time suddenly shift. And that happens in politics. I remember when the polling on same-sex marriage and marijuana was decidedly opposed to it. Within a few years, it massively shifted. I think we're seeing a big shift on guns, and I think you're going to see stuff happen on guns. I don't think we're going to go so far as to annihilate everyone's Second Amendment rights, but I think you're going to start to see some common sense things done on guns. And let me throw one out there. Right now, every state is supposed to submit background records to the FBI before people buy guns. A lot of states don't. Congress needs to pass a bill requiring states to participate in the FBI background check system. Washington State does. Every state should have to do that.
Is that it? We have background checks. Make the background checks work better.
Yeah,
is that about
good
it?
Good idea. And that would not harm anyone's constitutional
rights. But they should also
apply it to gun shows, online sales,
yes,
across the country.
As Washington
There
does.
Should be red flag or extreme risk protection legislation across the country. There should be a limit, a ban on AR-15s. I mean, some of this stuff is so obvious.
Are you arguing, Chris, that this is something is changing, tectonic.
Right.
Joni mentioned a bunch of them. 21 years old to buy a semi-automatic rifle. Do you think that whole list of stuff is going to happen?
I don't think that you are going, and I don't think you should, get to the point where you have an outright ban on semi-automatic rifles. I don't think that's going to happen, and I don't think it should happen. But I think many of the other things she just mentioned probably will. Close the gun show loophole, require the background checks to be meaningful. Say you got to be 21 to buy a rifle. Ban bump stocks. I think those things are going to happen bit by bit.
I think those things are things that Donald Trump might be induced to support, and therefore I don't think they go far enough. But
good indication.
High definition.
Good indication.
But I do think that with the background checks, they also need to be meaningful and not as there's been a lot of talk on the Trumpian side and even on the kind of gun lover side about, well, let's just make sure that people who are mentally ill can't get guns. Or Trump had talked about, speaking of authoritarian, building more mental hospitals and locking people up. And that's not, I mean, it's not people with diagnosed mental illnesses primarily who are doing this. It's people who have committed domestic violence primarily. And so I would just say that I hope that, I agree with you, Joni, that we need to have a more widespread and universal background check, but I think it needs to be meaningful and not just stigmatize groups that aren't actually causing the problem.
Well, one thing that concerns me about when we start talking about mental health, and no doubt we need to be funding all of that much, much more efficiently and with more money, basically. But once you get going on mental health, the reason that was the first idea thrown out by the president is it is a rabbit hole. You can get stuck in there by definitions. You can get stuck in there by who this state has enough funding, this state doesn't have enough funding. You get lost in there. It's the guns, folks, and we have to stay focused on that as well.
Right, but the problem is, and this is why it's politically very difficult, there are millions, tens of millions of Americans who own guns and are law-abiding and never break the law, and they are going to resist anything that they think is going to take away their constitutional rights. And so that's why you talk all you want about banning semi-automatic rifles.
Well,
like a whole lot of people own them and are not going to ever politically support that.
Well, right on, there's a line there that I'd like to point out, and I heard Governor John Kasich of Ohio say it. Mm-hmm. He said after this that he talked to one of his gun-owning friends and said, how much are your rights limited by you not being able to have an AR-15? And whoever this friend is, because I have no idea who it is, said, not that much. So we can draw lines
we, sure.
with
and we
with
have.
Sensible people.
And we have. You can't own automatic weapons. Well, you can't own hand grenades. You can't own flamethrowers. But you know, you can't pass a law banning one specific rifle. You'd have to ban all semi-automatic rifles, a lot of which don't look like military rifles. It just
But the need, try, the need
like
to have those...
And can I speak as the member, as the person here who comes from a gun-owning family?
Well,
and
I come from... I am a gun owner.
And, okay, sorry. I just want to say that I grew up around guns, and you know I don't know that any member of my family, except possibly one, would hi Dad, would politically object to this because what they have guns for, and you know, and I think they don't necessarily need to have arsenals, but what they have guns for is self-protection. They have pistols. They don't have AR-15s. They don't have military-style weapons, and I don't think that their rights would be trampled on if they're not allowed to get those military-style weapons, and I think that they would agree with me on that.
There, you know, I have a friend who owns a 22-caliber rifle. It's a wooden stock rifle. It's semi-automatic. You pull the trigger, and it fires a bullet every time. You don't have to cock it every time. No one would call that a military-style weapon, and nobody would want it banned.
Because it doesn't have a big magazine clip attached. Yeah.
But you know what, Chris? We're smart enough to handle that. We really are. We could figure that out.
Well,
that's workable.
Yeah. Having
in having watched it, I know it hasn't happened. Yeah, but I'm talking, you know.
And my big thing is there are a million things we can do to improve the situation with guns that aren't that controversial and that can pass if they can just get Republicans and Democrats together to actually work together and get it done.
Centrist third party, Chris Vance.
That sounds like failure to me. You mean we can't do things that are controversial? Of course we can.
Or hard.
Well, I also don't think they're constitutional, but
okay, that's a good place to pause. I want to talk about one more thing that President Trump did or said he will do this week. And here's the update. We said, what's going to be the reaction? Well, the president of the European Union executive body today said the EU will retaliate against tariffs that President Trump announced this week. Trump said he would levy big tariffs on foreign steel and aluminum. So today the European Union says it will, quote, treat American products the same way with tariffs on, quote, Harley-Davidson, bourbon, blue jeans, end quote. And what about Washington products, Chris? We export a lot of apples and wine and wheat.
This is an example of the insanity that's now gripped the Republican Party. Republicans were always pro-free trade, stood up and fought for NAFTA, fought for Trans-Pacific Partnership. Why? Because it's good politics. And centrist, moderate, not good politics, it's good economics. And centrist, moderate Democrats like Bill Clinton and Barack Obama also supported free trade agreements. This is going 180 degrees in the other direction. It's going to lead to a trade war. It's just higher taxes on everything made with aluminum and steel, which is pretty much everything, including houses. And they're going to retaliate.
And blue jeans, too. And,
well, they're going to retaliate against American products. And America's number one export is agricultural products. And that hits Washington State. And so this is just crazy. And the Republicans in Congress need to stand up and, on nothing else, oppose the president on this. A trade war hurts everybody. More than anybody else, it hurts Washington State, the most trade-dependent state in the nation.
Yes, and it hurts Boeing.
Yes, it does.
Very, very dramatically. You know, it was just another day on Trump TV here with a bunch of announcements that sent the stock market actually into one of the giant tumbles. And if you read the stories about what was going on behind the scenes in the White House, you know, so many people have resigned, been forced out. I don't work here anymore. There's just so much of that it was clearly described as, you know, John Kelly thought he had control here, the chief of staff, but no, he doesn't. The economic advisor, Gary Cohn, thought that he'd made his point, but oh, no, he doesn't. So what keeps happening here is that Trump feeds the sort of TV monster. He is, you know, got another big, huge announcement that affects the whole world. And they don't seem very well thought out. Too much shooting from the hip hourly.
He's a chaos agent, and he thrives on negative attention. I mean, he thrives on attention, and he prefers positive attention, but he'll take negative attention if he can get it. And his tweet, I think it was either yesterday or this morning, he said,
who can remember?
Trade wars are great.
Easy to win.
Trade wars are good and easy to win.
And I agree with Joni. I mean, this is a distraction. We should keep our eye on what's really going on with the Russia investigation, with the chaos in his administration. I can't predict if this is actually going to happen. If it does, it'll obviously be a tax on everybody at the expense or at the to benefit one industry. And that would be a disaster, and it will set off a trade war. But I would caution to just keep an eye on the stuff that Donald Trump doesn't want us to be paying attention to, because he does throw this stuff out there.
Yes.
To cover what he's doing on the other thing.
I agree with all of that, but I think there's a handful of things this guy actually does believe in. I think he is a protectionist. He believes in it. I think he's an isolationist. He's a nativist. When he talks about immigration and trade and foreign policy, these are the things he talked about his whole career. And this isn't a distraction. He's doing it. He's put tariffs on things already, including solar panels. He killed TPP. He's trying to kill NAFTA. He has wanted for months to slap these tariffs on steel and aluminum. And I think he's dead serious. And we are drifting bit by bit into a major trade war, which is horrible for our economy.
Then I want to help listeners a little here, because I hear protectionism being called insanity, crazy, and disaster. Well, I mean, he gets to be a protectionist, right? Like, isn't he just creating winners and losers, and the winners are domestic, in this case, domestic steel and aluminum producers? And even if there's economists don't like it, and there's way more losers and all that kind of stuff, I mean, are we overusing the word insanity here when we're talking about tariffs?
Some days you have to violate the Goldwater rule,
I, there's a great quote from an economist out there that talks about the one thing all economists agree on, which is protectionism doesn't work.
But protectionism also has to do with, he may be favoring slices that he likes, and he may be overvaluing some American identity that we produce our, you know, American steel and all the stuff that we could agree or disagree with. But I'm just trying to pause and say here, is it really insanity?
Yes. In my view, it is.
Not good for Washington State, I get.
It goes against this whole issue of being anti-globalist, you know. I mean, the entire Western world since World War II has moved to lower trade barriers, the WTO and the GATT, and this is going 180 degrees in the opposite direction. He's not alone in this. Brexit was the same sort of thing. There's a movement all across the world on this, and it is economic craziness.
So I think it's taking the booming economy for granted and assuming that there's no end to the expansion and no end to the boom. I'll use the word dangerous for the economy. It's not always going to be up, up, up. This could, and you know, everybody knows the history here, I assume. During the Depression, tariffs were a bad idea. They exacerbated the troubles that we had economically.
Yeah. Okay.
I think so much of this comes down, like everything, though, to Trump's personality. And you've seen him so easily be swayed by one meeting with a leader who is nice to him and, you know, and kind of
says nice things about him.
It says nice things, kisses up to him, throws a nice little ceremony for him. I don't want to call the president crazy, but I do think he has a very shallow personality.
A moment ago you said he loved negative attention, but wasn't he getting positive attention in Western Pennsylvania?
Happen to be a congressional race there in about a week.
But he's getting negative attention from the rest of the world, which is larger than Western Pennsylvania.
Yes. Okay, I'm Bill Radke, one of America's least respected economists, and my Week in Review panel, Chris Vance, a former state legislator, a King County Council member, and former Republican. Erica C. Barnett, covering the city at the Seas for Crank.com. Joni Balter, Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel, former Seattle Times opinion writer. And we've got more to come on the Week in Review. We're going to figure out a way to bring back the Sonics with no Soto Stadium and no basketball. It's perfect. Stay tuned. You're curious, right? Yeah. I can tell. What's that?
Peterkin skipped the event.
Oh, I saw that. Yes. Yeah, we're going to talk. So the NHL, it was something at the Space Needle.
Yeah, there was an event at the Space Needle to, I think, launch the season ticket drive.
Yes.
And we're going to talk about why Mayor Jenny Durkan did not attend that.
Indeed, really? In a moment.
She tweeted out a bunch of stuff being really supportive.
Oh, she's super supportive. Yes.
Ticket sales did not suffer from whatever this was.
We'll tell you all about it. Let's start this week with the fact that Seattle's, I would say, most celebrated living writer, Sherman Alexie, publicly acknowledged mistreating women somehow. He's accused of sexual harassment, at least. In a written statement, he says, "I have done things that have harmed other people, including those I love most deeply. To those whom I have hurt, I genuinely apologize." The allegations are not public yet, so I don't know how much we can say right now. The Institute of American Indian Arts has removed Alexei's name from one of their scholarships. His name is off the website of Seattle's Longhouse Media, which produces Native American films. Any reaction to what we know and mostly don't know so far?
I think as a apology is an example, yet another example of a bad apology by a man accused of something. We don't know exactly what he was accused of, but we know some details of the accusations, but his apology basically was one sentence saying what anyone in this room or the world could probably say, which is, "I'm sorry if I ever hurt anybody," but no details, and then spent, you know, several paragraphs basically trashing the person who brought these accusations to light, exposing an affair that he had with her and accusing her of basically being an unreliable witness, an unreliable source, and casting aspersions on, you know, whether the claims are even true.
He said they had had a consensual sexual relationship and were friendly afterward, basically, that she came to his events.
And that she came after his wife and called her and said something about to her on Facebook,
mm-hmm.
all of which is completely irrelevant to whatever the allegations are. So it just, to
is
me,
it was never okay to tell people why they might disbelieve an accuser? Is that a fair?
There are so many accusers at this point. I mean, this came up initially not from this woman, but from people commenting on in a journal.
Yes. Actually, I don't know that she's personally accusing him of mistreating her at all.
No, she's not. She's just kind of serving as a conduit for women who are coming to her and saying, "This happened to me." But she didn't initiate any of these accusations or push anybody to come forward as far as we know. So, no, I don't think the fact that she had a consensual affair with him is relevant at all.
One more question for Erica. So if you're accused of several things, is it never okay to say, some of the things I'm accused of are
bogus
and false?
You can't just say some number of things that I won't specify what any of them are lies, because when you do that, you're basically saying, you know, you can't believe anything you're told because I'm not going to tell you any specifics.
So it's his responsibility to spell out the details of his life and everything he did.
I think if he's going to apologize and expect credit for that apology, he needs to say, "Here's what I did. I'm taking responsibility for it. Here's why it was wrong. I'm sorry, and I won't do it again. And here are the actions I'm going to take going forward."
So this is a case that cries out for more facts. Very obviously, we all know that.
Yes,
we don't have
as
enough,
we've said,
we don't have enough information. And as I'll just say, with some of the folks I admire, because I admire Sherman Alexie a lot, as with all of these cases take some sort of processing of the shock of hearing this story, right? So clearly something happened, or he wouldn't have issued this apology, whether you like it or not. I think we have to be careful here erasing a whole very impressive career. We have to know more before we do that.
What do you mean erasing?
Well, I'm talking about removing him from this blog that people were doing, taking his name off of one of the prizes. I think we got a hold here before.
But how much gap is there between that and, as you said, erasing someone's career?
Well, we're beginning to erase his career, so I don't think we should do that until we know.
I haven't seen that happen to anybody who's been accused so far, though. I mean, except for maybe Harvey Weinstein. I haven't seen people's careers being accused, being erased.
Al Franken's
career. Al Franken's career.
I was going to say, Al Franken's career was erased. Garrison Keillor, I don't know the end of that, but that's another example. But, you know, it is a pretty impressive career. He's broken a lot of ground as a writer. I'm not ready to write him off. I'm ready to know more about it. Yeah. And I think we all better be darn careful about doing that.
That's fair. The head of Longhouse Media, Tracy Rector, who I mentioned, he was an advisory board member or something. He's, at least for now, off the website. And she said these allegations really hurt.
Truly, he's done some groundbreaking work, and he's opened the doors in many ways for a number of Native artists and authors and poets.
So hurtful for sure, and as you said, we are waiting for more. We don't know much.
One of the allegations involves telling people that he would ruin their careers. And again, mm-hmm. we do not know if this is an accurate description of what happened. So that's just what the allegation says. But that would seem to contradict, you know, some of the praise that's being spread, you know, on him right now. And you know, and I do think that his career will not be erased. He's still a best-selling author. He's still living off those winnings, you know.
And the threatening, I think he did specifically deny. He said, that's out of character. I don't remember ever.
He said, I don't remember.
Yeah. Okay. Right. That's
and fair. And saying, oh, that doesn't sound like something I would do again is a pretty weaselly type of apology. So I would hope for more details also and a better apology.
Okay.
Yes. Allegations are true.
Yes. Meanwhile, the head of Sound Transit is accused of racially insensitive language, swearing at employees, calling a female employee honey, and something called elevator eyes, which I think is looking people up and down. I'd never heard of that expression. But King County...
Wait, I'd never heard that. What is that?
Looking, that's the way I read it. The Seattle Times, I think it was.
Yeah.
Looking people up and down. Looking. So the county executive, Dow Constantine, said Peter Rogoff has an East Coast style. What do we make of that? Erica, that's an excellent facial expression.
The facial expression I'm making is just sort of contempt and disbelief for that phrase. I think it's a ridiculous thing for people on the West Coast to say that people on the East Coast get a pass for swearing at employees. And it's not just, you know, it's not just swearing around employees. It's what he's accused of, according to some of the memos that were released because of a public disclosure request, you know, is intimidating employees, calling them on the phone at 11 o'clock at night to cuss them out, dropping F-bombs left and right all the time, shoving a chair. And so I talked to Claudia Balducci, King County Council member who serves on the Sound Transit Board, and voted to essentially give him a very light penalty of being overseen by three people for the next 6 months to see if his behavior improves. But she said, I'm from New York. That's no excuse. We don't act like that. That's a behavior issue. It's not, you know, whether you're, you know, bracingly direct, I think, is another thing that the executive said about him. I don't agree that that's a description of people.
And he also basically got fined $31,000. So
because he didn't get his bonus?
Right, which he would have gotten otherwise. And I think the Sound Transit Board is taking this pretty seriously. Look... I understand how the world used to work, but it doesn't work that way anymore. And people have a right to go to work and not be harassed and sexually assaulted and intimidated and treated in despair. I mean, our laws and are very strong on this, and I'm glad to see that major organizations are enforcing that. That's a good thing for our society.
He sounds like a giant mismatch for Sound Transit Agency. It's not just about $31,000. I mean, I think if there was a way to take his 5% salary increase as well, let's talk about that, or let's see if that's possible.
Yeah, he's still got a raise.
He's still got a raise. I mean, we're going
to
sit here and cry over his
to $328,000
over his bonus. You know, I wasn't that thrown by the sort of honey, that ain't never going to happen here. Talk. It's the rest of the stuff that is really just doesn't sound like it works. It doesn't sound like it fits here. Throwing a chair. I don't know. You just kind of that's not East Coast or West Coast. That's anger management, and no management class is going to fix that.
Or
shoving.
Throwing a chair is another level.
Okay, sorry. Shoving.
Chairs roll. You know, they've got wheels on them, and
they go off by themselves.
You push them in frustration. 6 inches into a table. I don't know.
Well, yeah, but suggesting that that African Americans on the staff require more mentoring. I mean, this guy is out of line. He shouldn't really be leading this agency. I think we're learning that. I can deal with the difference between somebody from the East Coast and the West Coast and a little cultural directness, because we could use a little bit of that around here. But he just sounds like he's a jerk and he shouldn't be in this position.
And I think there was an executive session that went on for hours yesterday. There was an executive session before that at the previous Sound Transit meeting that went on for hours. So there's a lot we don't know. And I think that the stuff that we are being informed of voluntarily by Sound Transit is the tip of the iceberg. I asked Mayor Jenny Durkan why she voted against the motion, and she had no comment beyond her statement that there were issues of workplace harassment and racial insensitivity. But she knows a lot more than we know, and everybody in that room yesterday making that vote knows a lot more than we know. So I have never seen in my life an instance of sexual harassment or misbehavior that was a one-time thing. And I will say, I will relay just one quick story that I put in a tweet, which is that when I first met Peter Rogoff, it was in a panel that I moderated, and I was sitting next to him, and I was moderating a panel of a lot of people, and he kept sort of putting his hand on me during this panel in front of 200 people. And
on your what?
on my shoulder,
okay.
But while answering questions, just sort of holding my shoulder in a very, what I perceived to be a very dominating manner, and talking over me. But it was the hand that really struck me, not as an East Coast thing, but as an inappropriate thing.
I don't know Peter Rogoff. I never met him. I do think that this looks to me like an example of progressive discipline where it's rare where you just fire a public employee based on the first offense. You usually need to put down a marker and give him a warning. I would be surprised if he hasn't been made clear to him that this behavior continues, he will be terminated. I don't know. I think they're taking fairly aggressive action.
The board said he has to create a leadership development plan to improve his listening, self-awareness, and relationships.
So cues for employee behavior come from the man at the top. Mm-hmm. And yes, I'm humming the words to the Bruce Springsteen song. So what example is he setting for everyone else who works there? And he's going to get his raise, and he's going to go to management school. How many times has he been to management school? I forget. But, you know, and he's going to have his hand held to kind of bring him into shape. He just doesn't sound like he's the right guy for what we need from Sound Transit.
You know, the other context here is Sound Transit is an organization that's under some political attack constantly, especially from Republicans. And I think that might have played into the board's thinking one way or the other. Is this the time now to terminate our boss? I don't know. What to see about that?
Okay, one more item along these lines. The head of the King County Democrats accused of sexual harassment, and Bailey Stober has refused calls to resign. I think you wrote about this, Erica.
I've written about it a lot. Yeah, that's right. So essentially, he has been accused of behaving in a bullying manner, primarily bullying, but also sexual harassment of an employee who he fired, pressuring this employee to go out drinking with him, and just behaving in an unprofessional manner, also of financial improprieties, so spending money that they didn't have the budget for, spending money that was outside the budget. It's a lot of stuff, and he's refusing to resign. Which has created tremendous turmoil. King County Executive Constantine wrote a check to them for $5,000 and then rescinded it. They lost their space in Tukwila from the Teamsters. But he's refusing to resign. And I think this is an instance where it would be appropriate to resign, or at least temporarily, pending an investigation at the very least. And I think there's a lot of sentiment among the Democrats in that direction, too.
Yeah, I think if you can just ask him to step aside, put someone else in there, figure it out. These are allegations. We need to figure out who did what. But he doesn't sound like he's the right guy for that job.
Okay, we're going to step aside and figure it out, figure out what's happening with our pro hockey team. And we're going to do that in just a moment. Okay, finally, wrapping up the week in review, NHL hockey might actually be coming to Seattle. The league said, if you really want us, then put season tickets up for sale, and we'll see how many people put down deposits. So this week, the company that wants to bring a team to Key Arena held a sale on Ticketmaster. They said the goal would be 10,000 reservations. They sold at least 25,000, so maybe Seattle will once again have top-level pro hockey, and we will again sound like this.
Seattle, Dave Wisner pulled down from behind, going to his knees, still trying to deke the goaltender, and somehow the goaltender went with him to his left, Wisner's right as he cut from left to right, and the puck slid into the left side of the net. It's 3-1, Seattle in the lead.
Remember Seattle used to deke the goaltender? I don't know what that means, but that was Cairo AM's Rob Glazier with the call. Seattle totems against the Salt Lake City Golden Eagles sometime in the mid-70s. So that's a good sign for NHL, I guess.
Oh, they're up to 32,000.
32,000.
We are going to get an NHL team, and I can't wait.
And here's what a brilliant colleague of mine came up with. Here's the way you solve the angst over the Sonics having left us. Here comes our new NHL pro hockey team, the Seattle Sonics.
Oh, my gosh. Super All Sonics. The basketball fans are so mad at you
that,
right
that
now.
Will
because
not happen.
But what do you love
work?
About the Sonics is representing Seattle, right? Against the best
not,
of the best?
I think as long as it's not the totem.
That
What's
will not
difference?
Work because for basketball fans,
green,
there's only basketball.
The green,
they don't want
no,
that
no,
name
no.
going.
No, we have multiple sports in this city.
We have
the
a
green
lot of sports.
And, see? It's the green and gold, and you root for it. And Seattle's a world-class hockey city, and we're going to beat the Who's a good NHL hockey team?
The Vancouver Canucks.
Yeah, our rivals, the Vancouver Canucks. Sonics against the Canucks.
It's not going to happen.
Done.
Nice save, Bill.
It will happen. I deked the goaltender to save that one. Thank you.
I just think that the incredible excitement shown here for hockey is great news for hockey, but there is a very noisy, boisterous group of folks who very much want a basketball team back. And then that raises a whole bunch of questions. Would they sell as many of these tickets in a sort of a test case like this? Or does one more sport like this detract from their ability to do that? So remember, this was the search to get the Sonics back. And
We're going to get the Sonics back.
Not that one, dude. Different one.
Once the building's in place, it's inevitable that eventually we get an NBA team. And this whole thing, could we support two teams? I've lived here my whole life. It's funny. So many people still think of Seattle's a small town. This is a big town. It's a big metropolitan area. Of course we can handle an NBA team and an NHL team. Of course we can.
We'd be the smallest city that has that many pro teams. Although we do have the whole Pacific Northwest and Alaska.
But we draw from so many states.
It's just more sports for me to not go to.
That's right. It's fantastic. Everyone's a winner. That's the Week in Review. Thanks, team. Mm-hmm. What is deking the goaltender?
You fake out the goaltender and then go the other way with the puck.
Really?
Yep.
That's how you deke the goaltender?
Yes.
Well, we're all going to know that when the Sonics come.
I'm so glad to learn that.
But for right now, it's go Husky Hoops, go Sounders.
Go Husky Hoops, go Sounders. Chris Vance, Erica C. Barnett, see us for crank.com. Joni Balter, Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening.
See ya.
See ya.
Bye.